Well, last week we talked about, as I said, the stewardship of men. Each man has a God-given spiritual vocation, a stewardship that is entrusted to him not by other people, but by God himself. And that's a serious and privileged responsibility, one to which he will be held accountable. Regardless of how well or how poorly we have performed in the past, God has a plan from this point forward to guide men and their families and their marriages into this ideal. So that's really what we're focusing on here. We're not saying that you're all doing it wrong or that I'm any better than you are in that sense. What we're simply saying is there is a plan. We are to subscribe to that plan. We're to put it into action, and it will be good for us when we do so. Maybe you're already doing that, and that's great. And you are an inspiration and an example to the rest of us. But maybe you're not doing it too, and you need to be encouraged and motivated and, yes, even admonished to do that. The stewardship of men really has several contexts here. We talk about the physical family, marriage, home, job, friends, society, congregation. There's a lot of different hats that men wear, just like there's a lot of different hats that women wear in their respective responsibilities. So this lesson is going to focus really on man's stewardship over the home life. You say, well, I don't have a family and I don't have a wife. Well, you still have a home life. You are responsible for what happens in that home. So even if you're a single man or a single woman, you're still responsible. You're still the head of your family, so to speak. And you are still responsible to have a Christ-like environment in that home and to be a servant yourself. So God has a plan for men as to how to govern themselves and to govern their households. And realize that this is not a highly detailed plan. And it doesn't need to be either. It provides an overarching perspective here of the kind of attitude and behaviors that he expects. Not all Christian families follow this plan. And those that don't suffer. The parents suffer. The children suffer. The family suffers. And yes, even the congregations in which those families are a part of suffer from that. And this is evident in unproductive marriages, children out of control, a family that's lacking in spiritual direction, etc. And the saddest part of that whole scenario is it doesn't have to be that way. It is preventable. And it is fixable if it is that way now. Families that are guided by a positive, Christ-centered leadership, however, do very well. Their marriages are often rewarding and productive. The children are grounded in spiritual values. They have a healthy respect for the Lord. It is our endeavor, I hope, to be that kind of family and that kind of witness, that kind of light to the world. All right? That's our introduction. Now we'll get into the thick of it here. It is obvious, historically and through our own personal observation, that groups of people cannot function well without leadership. And not any leadership will do. That family may survive, or that group may survive, but it will not necessarily be productive, or it will not necessarily reach any particular objective. It will not necessarily enjoy meaningful relationships. So understand what I'm saying up front. Families can survive without good leadership. It's just that they won't survive very well, and they'll be sickly and like diseased families, in a sense, because they're just not really what they're supposed to be. Imagine a football team that huddles on the field. And the quarterback there in the huddle, you know, he's supposed to be giving out plays and directions and so on. And instead, he just kind of looks at his team and says, okay, you guys just do whatever you want. Everyone just go run a pattern. I don't care what. I'm going to throw the ball, and I'm not really sure where, but I hope that it hits one of you. Go, let's break. Okay, and then go out there and play ball. And I know what some of you men are thinking. We played turkey ball several years ago, and that's exactly how we played. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a professional sports team, all right? Not the Seahawks, a professional team. Anyway, so think about this idea here. If the quarterback is supposed to be giving instructions, and then the team responds because they have a plan because of what the quarterback has said. And if he doesn't give those instructions, nobody knows really what to do. And they're going to go out there, and they're all going to run patterns, and he's going to throw the ball, and it's going to hit the ground or be intercepted, and they're going to lose the game. Now I want you to think about that in a spiritual context or in a family context here, or where the father says to his family, in essence, you guys just do whatever you want, And I'm going to be the father dude, right? I'm going to be the father figure. I'm going to be this, you know, in this position of father. And I'm going to throw the ball, so to speak, and hopefully it'll hit one of you. And we'll make a touchdown. We'll be successful. Why is it that secular sports teams have more organization and communication than so many Christian families? That is an atrocity. That is unacceptable. Why is it that sports teams do better at those things than we do, perhaps, in our own families? And the fact is that many families do operate in a perpetual survival mode. They really don't know what's going on. There are families who live on the brink of collapse every day. They don't have a plan B. They're not even sure what plan A is. They often live from crisis to crisis. Their lives are marked from one crisis to another, from one tragedy to another, from one family fight to another, from one meltdown to another. Don't tell me you haven't seen these kind of families. They're all around us. Some of them are in a church. They're always stressful, and everyone in the family feels it. And yet they all feel like this is normal, because this is all they know. Everyone in the family is doing what they can to get as much attention and acceptance as they can. Everyone's searching for their identity, but nobody really knows what their identity is supposed to be. The house usually is in a state of clutter or disorganization or disrepair because the family is the same way. The physical surroundings often mirror the mental, the emotional, the spiritual state of the family itself. Or you could have a family that operates in a perpetual state of comatoseness, in a catatonic, almost zombie-like state of being. They are virtually drifting passively from day to day. They have no real goals. They have no real objectives. Everyone's just doing their own thing. Each member of the family is disconnected from the other. Dad's puttering in the garage. Mom's watching TV. The kids are, you know, again, catatonic-like on the video games, hours on end. And nobody is really connected to or even concerned about what's going on with the other family members there. Everyone's content to be disconnected, and that seems normal to them. There's little or no teaching going on. They just follow a daily routine. There's no sense of zeal or ambition or urgency because there's really no leadership, but everyone's just fading in and out of proximity to one another. They kind of pass in the hallway. They might meet at the dinner table, or they might not. There's just really no connection. Still, other families live in a perpetual state of superficiality. They are projecting a false image not only to themselves, but a false image to others as well. They have the appearance that they are Christian, godly, faithful, etc. people. They sit down to Bible study just so that they can say that they did, but nobody really believes what they're reading or learning. Therefore, nobody really lives like what the Word teaches, and yet they all walk away from the study going, "I'm good enough already." Dad makes his decisions and he puts his foot down, but everyone knows that Mom is the real leader and can revoke his decisions and undermine his authority whenever she wants to. Dad gets frustrated and he's unfulfilled, and he seeks to address those feelings of frustration with some secret little addiction or something like this. Mom pretends to be a supportive wife and a caring mother, but inside she's terribly unhappy and unfulfilled. She truly wants her husband to lead, ideally, and yet at the same time, she will not let go of her controlling, passive-aggressive behavior. She knows she's supposed to be submissive, but that sounds like slavery and bondage to her, so she pretends to be submissive while manipulating the family so that it goes in a direction that she wants it to go. The kids act polite and behaved and obedient when they need to, or when it's expedient, or when others are looking. But each one has been watching this charade going on for years and looking for opportunities now to exploit it to their own advantage, or they're so disgusted with the whole thing, they're looking for an opportunity to rebel in such a way that hurts their parents as much as possible. These are dysfunctional families. And yet, unfortunately, they're all too common pictures of what some people call the Christian family. And to these people, it seems normal. To those who are in these families, it just seems normal because this is all they know. And they don't know anything else. They've not seen, perhaps, anything else in their immediate family. And yet this is not normal. We use that word dysfunctional on purpose. And that word is revealing here. There's several important thoughts that word dysfunctional brings out here. First of all, dysfunctional does not mean non-functional. They do function, but they're functioning improperly, or they're functioning according to a wrong plan or a wrong design. Dysfunctional families still function, but without effectiveness or efficiency. So, yeah, it looks like things are happening, and it looks like they're functioning in some way, and they are. It's just not very well, and not what it should be. Last summer, we had some squirrels get into our underneath our van, and evil squirrels, and chewed up some of the wiring that goes to some of the fuel injectors there in our car. And I did not realize this until, of course, we're out in the road and the car starts lurching and jerking and everything. And what was happening was we lost a cylinder. We have a 6-cylinder engine and we're only running 5 cylinders. Not only that, but I'm watching the gas tank just go, because it's sucking gas and not burning it. And it's sucking a lot of gas. And so I've got this car with very poor performance and a very poor efficiency, and it's running fuel, but it's just wasting it, and it's chugging along. And yeah, I got from point A to point B, but I did it in the most inefficient manner possible. I had 5 cylinders when I was supposed to have 6. And so you're looking at that and you're saying, well, that's a dysfunctional engine. And you're correct, because it's not functioning like it's supposed to function. It did work, kind of, but it didn't work very well. I want you to draw that analogy now when there's a short, so to speak, in the circuitry of a family, and you're looking at how it's supposed to be wired or how it's supposed to function, and some of those wires are cut or snipped or just not there. Yeah, the family functions to some extent, but it's wasting a tremendous amount of energy, and there's all kinds of issues and everything else. It's still able to exist, but here's where the analogy breaks down. Where my car was able to get from point A to point B in a very expensive way, the family does not get from point A to point B. It just kind of meanders all over, and there is no objective. There is no point B. It doesn't know where it's going. And that's how some families are, and that's called dysfunctional. And in many cases, that cycle of dysfunctionality is perpetuated into the generations to come because mom and dad have taught the children how to be dysfunctional parents. And they become, not surprisingly, dysfunctional parents and teach their children how to be dysfunctional. And that's all very normal because it's all they know. It's not the way it's supposed to be, which is exactly why we call it dysfunctional. Dysfunctional also means there's a departure from what is fully functional. In other words, there must be a master plan for how the family ought to operate and ought to function and ought to prosper. It is amazing to me that we have godless people today who dismiss any moral reality or moral absolutes. They dismiss God, they dismiss all these things, and yet then they talk about dysfunctional families. And I'm just amazed by this, because in order to have a dysfunctional family, you must have a model functional family that everybody knows about and that follows some master plan that nobody wrote himself but is transcendent, because it's above all families. And we're all seeking to and appealing to this master plan. So they dismiss the master plan, but then talk about dysfunctional. That's like saying, well, there is no such thing as absolute right, but you're wrong to say such and such. Well, there is no wrong if there's no absolute right. You can't do that. It's called self-refuting logic. The world uses it a lot. If there is no master plan, you can't have a departure from the plan. But if there is a master plan, then that requires someone, and that's a capital S there, someone with supreme knowledge and authority to dictate that plan, not only to know it himself, but also to communicate it to the rest of us. And that's exactly the role that God plays here, is that he is the one who writes or authors the master plan, and then he communicates it to us in his word. He tells us exactly how it should be. And whether you're there or not, that's not the point here. The point is that there is a master plan, because there is a master who makes the plan. Third point we can make about dysfunctionality is that if a family is dysfunctional, it's only because the members of that family are not following that master plan. That means that the head of household is not following the plan, or the members of the family are not following the plan, or the head of household, or both. the head of household and the members simply have no clue what the master plan is or just refuse to follow it. And while this is a perilous situation in itself, it can be changed. It can be improved if the family comes to its senses and says, let's get back to the plan. Let's do what we're supposed to do. Let's find out what it was that God intended for us. Now, again, this plan, this master plan is simple and defined in very general terms, but just because the terms are general, the instructions are general, doesn't mean that it's any less important. Jesus says, for example, I want you to go and love like I loved you. Well, that's a very general command, but it's an extremely important one. So let's not confuse general with unimportant, or general and non-specific with non-significant, okay? Because that's not really what we're talking about. First of all, a man and a woman are married when they are joined by law to each other and in the sight of God. And let's look at the attitude that those two people are supposed to have toward one another in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12 through 14, which by itself has nothing to do with marriage. In other words, Paul is not talking about marriage here or married couples, but I want you to pick up on something, what he does say. In chapter 3 of Colossians, he says, those who have been chosen by God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. He said he's not talking about married people. I understand, but that's exactly the kind of attitude that two married people, especially Christians who are married to each other, ought to have, don't you think? And if you're in a relationship where your spouse is acting that way toward you and you're acting that way toward your spouse, isn't that going to take care of a lot of problems right there? And isn't that going to remove a lot of friction and tension right there? And isn't that going to create a desire for both parties to work together and resolve their issues and function properly as God designed them to do? This is a powerful passage to talk about marriage, when he's not even talking about marriage. He's talking about Christ-like behavior, which, if we have two Christians that are married together, are supposed to exhibit Christ-like behavior. Now, someone's going to say, well, my wife or my husband isn't a Christian, so I'm exempt from this. Oh, no. That just means that you're doing this, and you may not get that reciprocated to you, but you are still responsible to act this way, because he's still describing Christ-like behavior, and if you are a Christian, a Christ follower, that's what that means. They're also committed to the relationship, and they're committed to each other in the relationship. Matthew 19:6, what therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. That doesn't apply to only literal separation as divorce, but it also applies to anything that leads to that separation or incites separation, anything that ruptures a relationship. So it's not just a matter of, well, we didn't get divorced, so we're still okay, right? Well, no. I mean, if there's treachery and backstabbing and manipulation and all kinds of deceit going on, what you're doing is you're leading to that disruption, that rupture of the relationship. And these two people in this ideal scenario are not doing that. They're committed to the relationship because they're committed to each other, because they're each committed to Christ himself. You say, well, this is all very ideal. I know. It's the master plan. And we should be following it to the best of our ability. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives. Act in their best interest. Treat them as a soulmate. And if they are a Christian, treat them as a fellow heir of eternal life. Love them in a manner consistent with Christ's love for you. We have more to say on that, believe me, in the lessons to come. But that's part of the master plan. Ephesians 5:22 and verse 33 as well. Wives, be subject to or respect your husbands. Voluntarily put yourself under his leadership. Respect his God-given responsibility and position in the home. Don't undermine his leadership or authority by insisting that your will be done instead of Christ's. Because that's not submission. Fathers, Ephesians 6, 4, bring up your children in discipline and instruction, in the nurture and admonition, some versions say, of the Lord. In other words, teach them who the Lord is. Teach them how to have fellowship with the Lord. Teach them what all that means. And of course, lead by example. Teach them how to serve the Lord. And the best way you can do that is, go, of course, serve yourself. That is, be a servant yourself to the family. And don't exasperate your children or carelessly frustrate them with poor leadership or throwing stumbling blocks in their path. Ephesians 6, verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. These are not mere suggestions here. These are God-given prescriptions for a proper respect and compliance with dad's leadership of the family. God finds great favor with children who honor their mother and their father. And we can go even into Mark chapter 7, verse 9 through 13, and other places where in the New Testament where we find that part of honoring your parents means taking care of them when they get older and are less capable of taking care of themselves. And Jesus even cites that in Mark chapter 7. You know, the Jews are saying, well, whatever we would have given to God, or to our parents rather, we've given to God. And Jesus says, so you disobey the law of God in order to support your traditions, because honoring your mother and father means to help take care of them when they're unable to take care of themselves. And that doesn't mean that you forsake service to God or that you deny God his contribution. It means that you, in service to God, you take care of your parents. That's just part of it. I want to say on this note, as an aside, I see a number of you taking care of your parents in their older age, and I'm pretty impressed. I'm very impressed with what I see. You have set some model examples, several of you, and I really appreciate that. There may be a time when I have to take care of my parents in this very same way, and I hope to emulate what you have already done for yours. So this lesson is not to say that nobody's doing it. This lesson is simply to say there is a master plan, and this is part of it. This is not a comprehensive plan, but it is essential, and it steers us in the right direction. And if everyone in the family are doing these things, think about it. If everyone is doing their part, then this family is going to be like a well-oiled machine. It's going to function very well. It's not going to run on 5 or 4 cylinders. It's going to run on all 6 or maybe all 8, right? It's going to run fully functional, like it was designed to do, according to the master plan. Now, since we're addressing men and the stewardship of men, we'll briefly consider some roles of his more directly. Well, the husband, the father, this is what the man's supposed to be. He's supposed to be the head of the family, not a mere figurehead where everyone pretends, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. We pretend that dad's in charge, but we know he's really not. No, he is in charge in the sense that he is the head of that family, and he properly serves in that capacity. He takes God's charge very seriously. He treats his family, his wife and children, with dignity and respect. That's what he's supposed to do. And the reason why we cited 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 through 7 in the scripture reading is because that is not just a description of an elder candidate, like it didn't apply to anyone else. What Paul is really describing there is an ideal, mature Christian man, which even if you're not striving to be an elder in the church, you should strive to be a mature Christian man. So those descriptors there that he gives are very applicable across the board to men in general. If you want to be a man in favor of God, then do what he describes in that passage. Become that kind of man. And here's a man who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Well, if a man won't do that, or if he refuses to learn how to do that, he's failing to be a leader and a guide. Because management is a key ingredient to leadership. And here's a point to underscore in this lesson. If you refuse to manage, then you cease to be a leader. You can call yourself a leader all you want to, but by definition, you're not leading. And we could go so far as to say, as a leader has 3 essential components. This isn't in your notes, but we'll get to it in due time anyway. A leader is always someone who knows the way in which to go. A leader is someone who goes that way himself, and he also inspires other people to follow him. Those are the common characteristics of leadership that we find across the board in any kind of leadership. Even women who are leaders in their own capacity still do those same things. Even a nation, if it is to lead, still does the same thing. Management does not mean barking orders and threatening with intimidation and blowing your stack when somebody disobeys you, like some men think it is. It is a Christ-like oversight of the entire family and the environment in which the family lives. You might recall 1 Corinthians 16:14 that we cited in another passage where it says, "Let everything that you do, men, or let all that you do be done in love." That means as a father, as a husband, as a head of household, let it be done in love. Learn what love means in this context, and that will help you greatly. In the role of a husband, a man is to be the head of his wife. He is to be the leader, the provider, the protector, and yes, the intimate friend of his wife. Much to say on that. We'll do so in due time. He is to be faithful to his wife, the husband of one wife, 1 Timothy 3:2. Literally in the Greek, that means a one-woman man. It doesn't mean that he couldn't have been divorced before. It's not even the implication. And it does speak of something other than polygamy, okay? Monogamy, really. He's married to one woman. But it also implies something greater than just being married at one time to this one woman. It means that he is devoted to her. He is her one-woman man. That's the attitude that he has. He's devoted to her and not to any other woman, and not at least to any other woman in that same way. He will have family and so on that are women, but this wife of his, she's special. She's different. She is his woman, right? In that sense, in the most literal sense there. He is to be loving. Husbands, love your wives. Well, that's not a suggestion. That is a command. And that doesn't mean just love your wife when she cooperates, when she reciprocates, and when she's on her best behavior. Some men think that, I know, because I've seen it, I've heard it, right? Where some men say, well, if my wife is on her best behavior and reciprocates my love and does all these other things, then I'll love her. You're supposed to have an unconditional love, which means that you love her anyway. And you love her no matter what. You say, well, that's not fair. It's not about fairness. It's about love. God loves the evil as well as the good. You say, well, that's not fair. It's not about fairness. It's about the nature of God and what he does. That's about love in its highest expression. Men are to be seeking to imitate Christ in all that he does, not just at church, not just when others are looking, but in all of his behavior and all his conduct and all his thoughts. No hands, please, no pointing fingers, but how many of us have seen families where the man is a Christian indeed at church? But then you start looking into his home life and he is anything but a Christian. There's a man who's running on 5 cylinders when he should be on 6, or 4 when he should be on 8 or something. He's just not fully functional. In the role of a father, he is to be the ultimate father figure or authority figure over his children. In a real sense, and don't take this wrong, but that he is supposed to be in the closest role to God to that family. I'm not talking about that he becomes super powerful like God. I'm talking that his role is like God's role as a preserver, protector, provider, shepherd, etc. That's God's role to us, and that's what he does for the family and for his children in particular. He manages and provides for their well-being, not just their food and clothes. You can't just throw food and clothes at a child and expect that child to grow up into a model citizen. But rather, he offers spiritual nurturing and moral education, value-oriented teaching skills, and the like. Fathers ought to be preparing their children to enter into the adult world with a Christ-like attitude and hopefully a big-picture perspective. One thing I've told my kids since they were young, and I continue to say, and I think it's good advice, teach your children, fathers, how to be good Christians and to be good citizens. Not one or the other, but both. And that's the direction that you want to lead them in. How can they be good citizens and good Christians unless, of course, you lead them in that direction yourself? A man needs to take time to listen and communicate with his family. Communication is one of the most important skills of leadership. And of course, you're going to get some man who's going to come back and say, well, I'm not very good at this. Well then, men, I suggest strongly that you learn how to get better. Because your family needs to hear from you, and they need to hear where to go. They need to hear how to be led and so on. That your wife and your children need to know what God and you want of them. This is such an important part. We're going to spend a whole lesson on this later on. But it is part of the picture. That's why I'm bringing it up right now. Groups of people need direction. They need leadership. They need to be governed. And men have been entrusted with this responsibility first and foremost. That doesn't mean only. It means first and foremost. In other words, God lays that responsibility on men. And yes, women are supposed to support that and be a part of that too. And children have their part in that too. But really, it starts with the men. And that's what we talked about last week. And if a man will not do this, then he creates a dysfunctional environment, a dysfunctional situation. He forces his wife and his children into roles that they are not expected to fulfill, or he allows them to choose their own roles rather than to subscribe to the God-given pattern, the master plan. On the other hand, men who lead well and take their responsibility to heart and take their stewardship to heart often end up with strong, healthy, Christ-centered families. That was no accident that that happened, right? They didn't just bumble along and, boop, you know, my family's a God-centered family. I don't know how that happened. Oh, yes, you do, because you created that scenario, right? These things don't just happen. They are made. They are created. They are governed to that point, if you will. And that's exactly what every congregation longs to have. A congregation is a group of people, and yes, families within that group there. And a congregation itself is going to be dysfunctional if all it has is dysfunctional families within it. So what a congregation itself craves and needs desperately is functional, Christ-centered families where the man knows how to be a man. And the wife knows how to be a wife. And the children know how to be children. And everyone's doing their part like they're supposed to. Doing their best to subscribe to the master plan. Congregations look at families like that and say, please come be with us. Because that is exactly what they need. And that's exactly what this congregation needs. I'm not saying we don't have it. I'm just saying that's what we always need. Just as dysfunctional families may be perpetuated in the generations to come, so functional families likewise may be perpetuated in the generations to come. If you're treating your children right and nurturing them and disciplining them in the Lord and doing what you're supposed to do, fathers or grandfathers, for your grandchildren, then what you're doing is you're creating, hopefully, a very good, positive legacy for the future. Those children will want to continue in that, and they will teach their children. And now instead of a dysfunctional perpetuation, now you've got a functional one. Just because some man stood up and said, you know what, we're going to follow God's plan. And it's going to carry out for generations to come. So men, ask yourself, what kind of family do I have? How much godly leadership am I providing? The purpose of this lesson and this series is not to beat everyone up and say, see how much you've all failed. It's to encourage each one of us from this point forward to commit to doing better than what we've done before. And even if you've done well before, we want to commit to doing better than what you've done before. Excel still more. That's what we're looking at. So remember God's promise we talked about last week to Joshua. I will never leave you. I will never abandon you. But also remember the expected response to that promise. Joshua, you need to follow my word implicitly, and you also need to be strong and courageous. Have the courage and the faith to do what is right. Well, that same charge is still there to all us men in particular and to anyone who names the name of Christ. That's our lesson this morning. If you're subject to our invitation, if you need to respond, if you need to commit yourself to Christ and start on that path that we talked about, this will be a good time to do it. If you need to respond by coming forward this morning, then do so as we stand and sing the song that's been selected.